Because GPSA kind of sent me a number of questions ahead of time. So I'm going to try to answer those in as much detail as I can. And then also try to get some time for Q&A. Before I do that, I really want to do on the planning this body for updating the graduate and professional community mission, which is the CI document. We use this document a lot. The graduate student and other offices on campus that serve graduate students, I take this very seriously in developing support structures. When you look at a number of the improvements over the past 5-6 years that have been made in the lives of graduate and professional students, many of them can be directly attributed to the last update, which was in 2013. It's enormously important to us in establishing priorities. We make, I think, real progress on it. I can't take credit for much of the progress because much of it happened before I even got here, but I would encourage you to go to the project progress update on the graduate student website. And take a look, because I think the effect of the 2013 update had, we're going to see the same fund, same thing this time around. Everything from improvements in the Bay Grove Bar, establishing a new appointment support office, better services for families, boost for your resources, the Maplewood Housing Project, all of those stemmed out of succession ideas and suggestions in the 2013 update. So I know people put a lot of time into that. Okay, let me turn to the questions slash topics that people ask me to talk about. The first, and it seems like it's always the first when I talk to any group, is mental health and well-being. As you know, this isn't an issue just at Cornell. I just got back, I was in Washington, D.C. last week with the AAU presidents. These are the 62 leading research universities in this country. And mental health on campus was a major topic at that meeting. There are some very concerning studies, you've probably all seen them, talking about a significant uptake in the number of students globally, not even nationally, who are diagnosed with mental illnesses and are seeking help, and this notably includes graduate students. All of our peers, like us, have added capacity to the counseling staff, and all of our peers, like us, have immediately found that we've added that capacity. Also, you know, if you build it, they will come through that capacity. There's even more demand. So we're all scrambling to keep up. I think you know that over the past 10 to 12 years, we've almost increased by almost 50% the number of counselors and added $2.5 million a year to pass. So what we're all starting to realize is that while we do need to continue almost inevitably to expand the counseling staff, we have to do more. We have to take a really holistic approach, looking not just at what we can do to treat mental illness, but how we improve mental wellness more broadly. So I think I'll let you know that under the oversight of Vice President Ryan Lombardi, there's a comprehensive mental wellness review currently underway, looking not just to clinical care, but in collaboration with the community environment. The Mental Health Review Committee will include graduate and professional students, and we'll be very intentional in looking specifically at the mental health issues that all of you have quite appropriately pointed out to us are most relevant to the graduate and professional students population. In the meantime, while that review is going on, and by the way, we are committed, as I said when I talked to you about this, I think it was earlier this semester or late last semester, we are committed to making the results of that public. There's no intent to hide anything. We are, in the meantime, making some significant changes to improve access starting this fall. So we're going to eliminate the requirement for assessment and intake appointments prior to scheduling, prior to seeing a therapist. We're going to be scheduling appointments differently so that we have a robust availability of sitting appointments that are not released until that day. So you'll still be able to make an appointment in advance, but we're also going to have a large number of same-day appointments, which I think should be particularly helpful for graduate students given the time constraints you have, which are often more complicated than undergraduates. We're going to seek other improvements like matching the length and number of sessions to students' needs and goals, so we'll have both brief goal-focused sessions and longer-term sessions. We're going to improve access to psychotropic medicine management services. I know there has also been concern in the past that graduate students were disproportionately referred out of PACS and into community care. We recognize that, and we are changing that, and PACS is committed to ensuring that all students, graduate and graduate, are served by that. For graduate students specifically, we are piloting, we're going to have to see how this works, but we're piloting a support group for graduate students who are on health leave absences, so we can also see how that works. And the Let's Talk program, which has gotten a lot of very positive feedback, is being expanded, available in more locations, including Caldwell Hall, and is continuing to improve rates to provide better continuity for graduate students specifically. You also have a number of questions, and I want to get to the other topics, but I know that mental health is, I mean, there isn't a meeting I have with students where there isn't an issue, so maybe I will just pause, and if people have questions on this, I will take them, and then I will try to get through the other topics.
So if anyone has any questions, please raise your hand and I will see. Any questions on the line?
Okay, I'll continue, and then they can ask. Same question, because I thought a really interesting one about teaching at the university. And what's the place, we've actually written this, what's the place of teaching and education for Cornell as opposed to research and support for professors and TAs on teaching techniques and resources? I very firmly believe that for many, many years in higher education, that research and teaching really are both critical and are both critically important. And I want to read you a one-sentence quote from Andrew Dixon White, our first president, who said, "The power of discovering truth and the power of imparting it are almost invariably found in them." That is, at a great university, a great research university, research is incredibly important. One of the ways you advance that research is by teaching. I think all of you know that there's no better way to learn your material than to teach it. And for our students who are learning, having exposure to the research is the best way for them to learn. Some of you have heard me talk endlessly about more of my four priorities as president: academic distinction, educational verve, civic responsibility, notable ability, affordability, and access, and One Cornell. And educational verve, that second pillar, is all about teaching. Both Carlos and I are really committed to excellence in research and teaching. You guys, the graduate students, will not all go into university positions, but almost all university positions will be filled by you guys. And so it is really important that you get the preparation you need to do research and teaching. And I want to point you to two resources that are available. First of all, the Center for Teaching Innovation, which is under the immediate direction of Matt Ouellette is the director, but the Vice Provost for Academic Innovation, Julia Chapman, who oversees all of this. They provide a broad range of services and programs in pedagogy, in teaching. And I want to mention a few that are specific for graduate students, which in case you don't know about them and would like to check them out. There are institutes and courses, there's two credit courses in teaching and higher education. There are periodically and regularly workshops and topics like teaching critical reading and literature, how to assess learning, developing online course modules. I mentioned this last time I was here as a response to the presidential task force. There was created an online course on teaching the multicultural classrooms, which is available online that anyone is able to take it. Over the next year, with support from the graduate school, CPI is developing an online teaching assistant training module that will be easily adaptable for either individuals or groups of people. Really, CPI is a remarkable resource. I think Matt is doing a fabulous job there, as is the company, and I urge you to check it out. Another resource is within the graduate school itself. That's the Center for Integration of Research, Teaching, and Learning. They have future faculty development programs, things like programs on the scholarship of teaching and learning, inclusive excellence workshops, academic job search series, building mentoring skill series, and so on. So that is another resource. Again, why don't I pause for a minute? Is there more you'd like to know about teaching?
Any questions on teaching?
Okay. Diversity and inclusion, which again is one of my absolute central priorities. If there are first-year students here, you may not know about last year's presidential task force. There are actually two courses. There was a presidential task force on campus climate, and then the provost had a task force to enhance faculty diversity. Both of those reports came out with a large number of actionable requests, a very large number. There were initially 150 or so, I don't remember exactly, and then we took ones that were essentially similar and organized it. And we put them into various buckets. The first buckets were things that were already done. So, you know, shame on us. If we had done something and the community didn't know it, we need to do a better job of talking about it. The second were ones we would do immediately. That is this academic year, 1-1 year. The third were ones that we really wanted to do, but, you know, we couldn't do everything all at once, so they'll be done within the next year or two. And then the fourth bucket were things that were really aspirational, things we would like to do, but perhaps would take a very significant amount of resources, and so we had to put them off. There is to hold the entire community accountable. A lot of these initiatives are things that are being done by administration, but some of them are things that student government has to do, and others of them are things that schools and colleges have to do. We created a spreadsheet. It's a website. If you go to, I always forget where it is, university.cornell.edu, and you click on institutional initiatives, you can take a look at this is what's been done, this is what will be done, this is what is aspirational, and so on. I'm not going to go through the whole list. It's very long. There's a lot of work still to be done, but there are a lot of good things that have been done. I want to mention just a handful of things most relevant to graduate and professional students. So the graduate school and the professional students, the place to go is both in the active inclusion efforts. These include things like retention and recruitment, and they're supported by guidance from the diversity councils in the schools and colleges, which have graduate and professional school representatives. The graduate school has been able to redirect financial resources to increase the number of Dean's Excellence and other diversity recruiting scholarships, as well as to increase the number of completion fellowships for students who come from diverse backgrounds. So these are very discreet attempts to diversify and support the success of a diverse graduate student population. In a sense, it's the graduate student putting its money where its faculty department were. International students, we're very concerned with international students. They comprise about 48% of our graduate students and about 32% of our professional students. Nationally, we're seeing a decline in international grad professional student enrollment. At Cornell, it is increasing, we're holding steady, but we are very concerned. I am personally very concerned about immigration policies that are making it much more difficult for this student body. Hopefully, to brag a little, you got to see my op-ed piece in CNN on campus, and I am also working with our national organizations, so on, for advocacy in Washington. It's much more effective to do that in consortia than as individuals. Additionally, to talk about another group that adds to our diversity that I think gets overlooked a lot, the graduate school is actively recruiting students with disabilities through a range of programs, including the Cornell Initiative for Maximizing Student Development. This is in partnership with the National Technical Institute of Deaf, and also for Entry Point, which is a program of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is geared towards identifying students with both apparent and non-apparent disabilities. So that's, I'm just really scratching the surface, but if I were to walk through all the initiatives going on, I would lose all of our time. As always, my entire leadership team cares very deeply about issues of diversity and inclusion. So I think of the first as numbers and the latter as feeling, you know, programs that help people feel welcome and thrive. And if you have thoughts on either of them, I always welcome them. The next question was about student debt. I assume you're talking about graduate student debt. Let me just mention that at the undergraduate level, we've been keeping financial aid apace. There have been tuition increases. The tuition increase this year was actually the lowest in 50 years. But more importantly, we've increased financial aid apace so that no undergraduate who is here on aid sees an increase in their cost of attendance. And in fact, when you adjust for inflation, students with aid are paying less than they did 20 years ago. Do we have issues? Is the middle class squeezed? Absolutely. Do we need to raise more financial aid so that we can drive down costs, drive down some of the burdens, absolutely. And I am out on the road, always trying to raise financial for this. It's expensive to provide the kind of education all of you want. Now, for graduate students, let's first talk about graduate and then professional. The majority, the overwhelming majority of our graduate students have funding from Cornell or other sources. And only about 5% of doctoral students graduate with debt from their graduate education. Right? They may have debt from their undergraduate education that they come in with, but 95% of our graduate students don't have that. The challenges with professional students, we do understand that debt is a problem for professional students. And I would say, especially in the schools where the professions aren't incredibly high-paying professions. And let me just be straightforward about that. Veterinary school is the place that we're really worried about, because the salaries of vets are just not what one would want them to be. So all of our professional schools are trying to address debt levels by moderating the rate of tuition increases and expanding scholarships. And the College of Veterinary Medicine in particular is looking at this from several angles. They are also really trying to grow the endowment for scholarships. They're offering business courses to support student success so that debt can be paid down a little more easily. The new Center for Veterinary Business and Entrepreneurship, which is joint between the vet school and St. Johnson College of Business, is, we hope, going to advance research and training and outreach in the veterinary business. We also, again, on the advocacy front, continue to advocate with congressional leaders for public service loan forgiveness, which is very important. Our law school, for example, if you go to public service law, it's different than if you go to public service. Questions at this point? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Lynn. I'm an MPA student in SIPA. Thank you so much for being here. And I have a diversity question.
Okay.
I'm wondering about the initiatives that were proposed in the past several months since they started. If there are any initiatives that started in that second bucket of media that have needed to be pushed back to a future or a
You know, it's a really good question, and I don't have an exact answer for you because it's a really big list.
Yeah.
And also, we're still in that first year, so we're still hoping. Does any of my team back there know whether anything got pushed out to next year? Oh, I know one thing that got pushed out is the we are redoing the process for bias reporting, and we've made a lot of progress on it, but I don't think we're going to get that completely done by the end of the year. It's a great question, and I would encourage you to go take a look. And we list every stages of everything.
Yeah, thanks. So you mentioned about recruiting more students to it for a school. And I was wondering, so I know there's been some commentary in the past about how Cornell's campus is not terribly accessible, and I know that's a huge part of it. Certainly. And I was wondering, do you know much about retention for students? So what's the their experience all right? Are they supported?
Yeah.
Specifically, is it, are they going to sketch?
Yeah. So I don't have retention data. I do know that there have been concerns about things like parking that Vice President Lombardi and his office are working with the facilities people to try and address as they do this outreach process, as they do this, I'm sorry, I'm mixing in my head. I'm thinking of a clinical function. But we will want to actually ask you about it. I don't know. I'll take one more, and then, because I do want to get to your other questions.
Come back, come next.
Oh, wait, two more.
Sorry, yeah, I don't hear from
you
time to really quick questions on that. Just one, what are you looking to time on your property for? Like, is this constantly updating the website? Or is it like after 2 years, people work for kids? The second question was in regards to international students. I know they often get counted as a separate bucket, separate from domestic students of color and all the other types of diversity. And how does retention work on that? Because I know very specifically diversity at Cornell only considers international students separate from domestic students of color, even if you're international.
So on the first question, we've been updating the website once, three times a year, once a semester. So we updated it in September, we updated it in December, January, and we will update it again at the end of the spring. Because now we don't want to update it more quickly, because we'd rather be spending our time on the initiatives than on trying to do a lot of things. You know, we have to report to the federal government. There are federal guidelines for how we report diversity. And the federal guidelines say to us that when you're reporting, say, underrepresented minorities, that you only take that as a portion of the domestic population, and that you report international students separately. And I always want to be incredibly respectful of how people self-identify. So I don't want to make a presumption as to whether someone would rather be identified as international or international and person of color, or person of color and not international. I welcome all forms of diversity, but the reporting guidelines we use come from the way in which the federal government wants us to report about. Obviously, there's intersectionality. Obviously, work that we do, for example, for climate around people of color, will also help students who are international and are people of color. But there are also clearly issues around immigration, particularly.
And
that
way.
Taking the form of financial aid dollars from professional schools, or is it other kinds of
diversity recruiting?
Yeah.
So when we recruit for diversity, what that means is we're trying at all levels, undergraduate, graduate, professional, we're trying at all levels to make known to a very diverse group of applicants that we want them. Right, that we want them here. We do need at the undergraduate level, we do need-blind admission, and then we provide need-based scholarships only. So your scholarship is based on socioeconomic diversity, but nothing else. And at the graduate and professional schools, as you know, it's different place, but the recruiting has to do with telling people that they're welcome here and trying to get their voices to help us make it even better. Okay, sorry, the College of Engineering just awarded the lovely ceremony for the distinguished engineering alumnus, who, if anyone has a cell phone, does anyone here not have a cell phone? The distinguished engineering alumnus this year was Erwin Jacobs, who invented CDMA. And if you're carrying a cell phone, you're using all this technology. I have a dinner for him. Let me try to get to your other questions. What was this sort of vague notion of One Cornell? And more importantly, how do we build community across our campuses and colleges? Look, I think that what really distinguishes us is a combination. It's that we're theoretical and practical. This really is a graduate and professional student association. We care about art, we care about architecture, we care about music, and we care about medicine. Really span theory and practice. We span pure liberal arts, pure, you know, life of the mind, and then this engagement with the world, being a land-grant university, and now we span urban and rural. And both the provost and I are really deeply committed to trying to create a culture of collaboration. We're doing that in part by trying to support interdisciplinary initiatives of all kinds. So radical collaborations are the most obvious, but there are interdisciplinary programs. I bet half of you are involved in programs. The New York City Visioning Committee was a committee. It started with faculty. It did not, and I'll be honest, it didn't have students on the initial committee. That was frankly because what we were asking them to do was create a vision for what Cornell should be in 10 years in New York and Ithaca. They're the ones who are going to be here in 10 years. They spun out a large number of ideas. If you go to the website nyc.cornell.edu, you can see them. You can also see information about travel and site places to stay in New York. We also recently issued a request for proposals for faculty-led initiatives that will enhance learning opportunities in the city. Again, if you have ideas of things that from a graduate or professional student perspective you'd like to see in terms of spanning the campuses, while Cornell Tech and Ithaca, please, you know, send them to the dean of the graduate school and she will filter them to me. We are very interested in that. And, you know, kind of as an aside, we'll go back to the beginning before I make my very final point. I also think that social connection, I'm talking about a culture of collaboration. Intellectual collaboration is great, but half the time or more, intellectual collaboration, I think, goes out of social collaboration. So the one time, I'm embarrassed to admit I only did it once, but the one time I went to the Big Red Barn, it was great. There's a million students here. They're drinking beer. They're having a great time. And I walked over to one table, and everybody at that table was from science. And then I walked to the next table, and everybody at that table was from physics. And that, you know, so my ask of all of you, I'm always telling you, please make ask us. My ask of all of you is the next time you're in the Big Red Barn, intellectual diversity, you know, diversity of what you're studying is another really important form of diversity. So, you know, if you're where's a plant science guy, you have a task to go sit with the physicists.
We're already in two.
Touché. Okay, so the last thing I want to mention is the core value statements. Mary Jackman, the vice president and chief human resources officer sitting in the back, has been meeting with many groups around campus, including the number of GPS leaders. She met with them in February. We're creating this core value statement, and this grew out of the presidential task force. The presidential task force recommended, actually, so did the provost task force on diversifying the faculty, recommended that we need a university core value statement. Now, I said at the time that if I went around and stuck this microphone into the face of, you know, 50 people across campus, there'd be probably an 80% overlap in what they specified as core values. I mean, I think as members of the Cornell community, we actually have a pretty good sense of what our core values are, and we share that sense. But it's still really important to have that written down somewhere. And people say, you know, why? What are you going to do with it? I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to do two things. One thing is we're going to hand it to every new member of our community. If you come into this community as a student or a faculty member or a staff member, we're going to give you this. And we're going to say, these are our core values. These are what we expect you to live up to. And when you don't, you know, we can point back to them. The other thing we will do, we will do this in my leadership team and then at the assemblies and so on, will do it, is they will rely on these in decision making. It's really, really helpful when you're making hard decisions. And I tell people this all the time. Almost always the hardest decisions arise when there's a clash of deeply held values. Right? So in an academic setting, it's a clash between valuing free speech and valuing an environment in which everyone feels welcome. But those are the really hard questions. And if you have a clear statement of your core values, it really helps you in those moments of crisis. I hope you all saw the email I sent out right after spring break asking for community input. It is not too late. It's up on the website. You have until April 30th. I know it's a really busy time, but this isn't just symbolic. I think that this really matters to who we are at Cornell, and so I would encourage you to take a look. And with that, I probably have time for one question. Okay, two questions.
About this topic or just
any topic?
Okay. There was an editorial that came out yesterday called Daily Sun that was discussing the recent statements you put out in reference to events such as the Arts Quad or Chicago. So my question is twofold. One is, what is goes in the process of making those statements and when did you make those statements? And also, like, what are you attempts to accomplish with these statements?
So that's a really great question. And I'm going to be honest, don't worry, the Vice President for Communications is here, a university relations officer. It is a very, very difficult question, right? Because there are horrible events in the world every single day. And there is a question of, you know, what events rise to the level of horribleness that one that I feel compelled to make a statement. I think, rightly or wrongly, communities look to their leaders to express sympathy with these events. When I don't make a statement, people criticize it. When I do make a statement, they count the number of words in the statement and compare them. And what's meant to be conveyed is simply really a sense of how awful this is and how we're not alone and that we are looking to this. I think it has become difficult. You know, when the events touch our own campus, it's very clear. it's events like the absolute horrific. I mean, I'm still just horrified about yesterday's events. We have three Moroccan students on campus. And my heart goes out to everyone involved. To me, that was, you know, there was no way to ignore that. But, you know, then you don't want people to feel left out when some smaller occurs. So one of the things that we're going to look at this summer is our staging policy and what we say and what we say. All I can say is that today, it's simply meant to be a gesture of support. Okay, there's one more question.
Hi, Josh. Hi, so one of the draft core value statements is respect the natural environment. And recently, all four students on the Visit and the Faculty Senate voted that Cornell should invest in fossil fuels. The trustees refuse. I'm wondering if you think it's wise that Cornell's endowment profitability is tied to the profitability of fossil fuel companies, especially as in the next 10 years, we must force them to not burn about 4/5 of their assets to save those community resources.
Yeah. Look, first of all, that wasn't recent. That was several years ago before I even got here. And the board, it is up to the Board of Trustees to make that decision. The board has a policy, and their view expressed at that time was that the endowment should not be used for political purposes. What I want to stress is that divestment or not divestment, what this university needs to be committed to is doing the right thing here on campus. And I think that is unquestionably the case. We are number 8 in Princeton's ranking of top green universities above all of our peers. We're the top Ivy in the ASHE Star rating. Just a month ago, we opened a new 18 megawatt solar farm. It's our 6th large scale solar farm. We've driven down our carbon footprint by 36% since 2008. We are, as you know, invested very heavily in trying to make Earth source heating work, which if it does, would not only get us to carbon neutrality, but would have an enormous impact on the world. It really builds on this engaged learning. Where we are really trying to focus is on doing the right thing on campus. The decisions of the endowments. And with that, I'll finish up.
Let's get back to business. We'll go back to a few of the minutes. And we'll start with the Washington committee. Are there any comments and amendments for the Washington committee? Minutes.
Motion to approve
March
25th.
Second. Okay. The minutes for March 25th have been approved.
Does anyone just have to ask for it? Do you get everyone at once?
Now let's go on and approve the minutes for the people. Are there any minutes, questions, comments for the people? Yeah. Okay, there's been a motion to approve the minutes. There's been a second. There's a second. The minutes have been Okay, next on the agenda is our division breakout, and this division breakout will be focusing on the elections of our voting members and the division chiefs. So, as always, we'll have professional folks up in the front of the room, humanities, social science, life science, physical science, how about that?
Thank you.
can see.
So,
just Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Nate. And there's a description of the positions in your meeting packet and in the emails that I've sent. And I will also resend that prior to our next meeting.
And let's clarify, it doesn't matter if you've already been chosen as a voting member today or if you're not a voting member at all, you're still eligible for everything.
That is correct. Yes. You're still not. Okay, next on the agenda we have. Old business, and the first is resolution number 5, ratification of the Advocacy City Government Group. And here I'm going to pass on the gavel to Alex. I will be chairing the session since I am a sponsor of this resolution.
All right, so I'll let Andy discuss. I don't know why you can't be right.
So just a brief overview of what we're doing here. Last time we introduced this resolution, which is to ratify and make official the ID Plus Constitution. So I guess we'll open up a session of quick questions.
So the way it works is last time we had the Q&A session. Now it's open to open forum where we can amend, discuss, etc.
What other information? Can you just move 30 seconds to refresh the library we have a call?
Of course, yes. So now that the resolution is up here, what this does is it goes over the constitution for the ID Plus Student Group, which is part of the appendix. What that specifies is membership, decision making procedures, and it is part of the ID Plus Students Group. And we are required by the ID Plus Summit members to pass on this resolution at all institutions. And there is the actual resolution. Any questions about the resolution? Yes.
Yes. So, firstly, I want to say thank you to everyone who worked really hard on this. And I think it's worth ratifying just because it's better than nothing. But I do feel like there are some, things to take into consideration. So the first one is that making voting unanimous, I think, makes it untouchable the bigger the body gets, and I think that's something to consider. In a sense, it's like enforcing an internal planning type of policy. Number two is the vision and the values need to be shaped, I think, as soon as possible. Just think about it. At the Philadelphia Convention, you know, Madison didn't, you know, write the Constitution without any values in mind. Thing should be held for this constitution. And then the third one is that policies are only as good as they can be enforced. So in the event that a school cannot post for financial reasons, we should add something about providing corroborating evidence that that is the case. It should not just be on a word-for-word basis. And then also I think that the financial limit of $1,500 should be adjusted for inflation every X amount of years. And then I think that's it. Thank you.
All right. The floor. Do you have an amendment or just a comment? The floor is open. Nate?
Yeah. I think those are just two concerns. I'll mention first the inflation one is that the $1,500 should be reevaluated periodically. So it's probably more changes necessary than needed. But hopefully, I'm hoping that that will happen now. It's a tricky point when it comes to making amendments or making changes of unanimous versus if there's this unanimous vote and enforcement, there's no executive branch, there's no enforcing anything, which kind of makes things de facto unanimous in a way. So it's worth considering, but the one of the arguments we made when we were deciding on how to adopt the Constitution or how to set changes is the fact that there's no force to keep things from your hosting. If you just decide I'm not going to invite anyone at all, I was invited. I'll pick Ohio State, Michigan, and Colorado. And there's nothing anyone else to do about that. So it's kind of an acquiescence in the fact that we have the power to enforce anything. So recognizing that it's definitely an acquiescence. I know. It's a kind of a weak case, which that's kind of why part of that there. So, sorry.
All right, there's currently no one on the speaker. Yes, Matt.
Yeah, I think we're talking about, I mean, in essence, it's a very
read the Barrow's Constitution, but I just read the nothing, and it does. Knowing the backstory for what happened in terms of the direct or cause, not having governing rules, if you want to add someone. Thank you. I think Constitution works. I will have to say, though, my concern is primarily with the rules that are on Constitution Resolution 6. As far as this Constitution goes, I think, again, what it does lay out is relatively basic structure of the work, and you want to expand on it, the reason you can't expand on it later. But considering that it is, this is more of an ad hoc group that meets once on some conference, I don't think we necessarily need to cover too many rules, considering the fact that usually every year you're going to have incredible turnover on your cases, so you reinvent the wheel because that's your reinvent the wheel. And with that, I vote for the
All right, so there's been a motion to vote on the full resolution. A motion to second it. Is there any dissent to voting on the resolution? Seeing none, I'm going to ask voting members who wish to approve this resolution, please raise your hand and vote. Those opposed. All right, and those abstain. How many do we
have? 26.
20 members. Okay. So 18-0-2, the resolution passes. Okay, well, then.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to the second resolution 6. And this is along the same lines, but this is to approve the rules.
I'm not a math person.
Again, it looks almost identical, but not entirely, to the previous resolution. And what the rules specify are the hosting queue, voting procedures. And the financial obligation, which is $1,500 for you.
All right, so the floor is open for speakers. Yes, Matt?
So I think my concern, and I've heard this before, is looking at lines on the appendix, right? Lines 60-71, three bullets, it just often appears to be like they're saying things in the message, what they're, the values they're espousing don't necessarily have the actions that are created. Such that, in essence, if you want to host, you're rotating host, and the only reason you're not host is due to finances, I find it interesting that it requires a unanimous vote to approve host instead of a vote to remove the host. Such that, in essence, yes, you can host, everyone has to agree it's host, but if next in line, it would appear to make sense that it should be the opposite. If Brown is next on the line, and for some reason Brown can't host, we should be a mechanism to allow Brown to skip instead of remove the host, they agree to Brown. This direct recruit every year. And when if any single party can veto, in essence, the order to me is crazy to decide that because any one school can go, oh, I don't want to go to Brown or skip. Oh, I don't want to go to Harvard or skip. And in essence, it just creates a situation where the designated order is seems superfluous because if any single school can, in essence, go out on where they want to bring everything. And even though it says it's only finances, it just it seems to me that now you can stop people and have them back to
do you wish to make an amendment then or not?
My point of information is, what is this amendable such that if you amend it, and you consider it's a big number from all the schools across the state, you amend the amendment.
Right, I'm going to write that to Nisha and then Victoria will be on to you.
So I think that if all of these things are amendable, obviously, and then just having been a delegate before, anything that would be related to finances like this would usually not be voted on at the summit, so it's about to go from the responsibility to our body, and if you're going to have your body, we're not so comfortable voting on it here, but we can change it. I think it's important to note that there are two reasons why a school either would not or should not host. One is that they themselves can't cover the cost of it, which we're hoping to eliminate, given that each school is contributing to the covering fee or the hosting fee. The other is that delegates from other institutions can't travel that way. And so I think the only school really that schools have said I can't travel to is University of Chicago. But like as we grow out, you know, there are other schools, Duke, Stanford, Berkeley that like most schools would not be able to travel to. So it's less about a school not wanting to host and more about delegates saying, I physically can't make it to that location without that ever travel budget. And each school has a specific travel budget. So some schools, they're probably fine flying all of their members to use Cali or Berkeley, but obviously not.
Next is Victoria.
Yeah, so kind of going off that point, my biggest concern is that because there are no formal barriers to entry, you know, as the pool of schools grows, schools can essentially just decide for themselves, like, we can't afford this, and because the cost is currently stagnant in concentration, the burden of hosting will fall on a specific set of schools.
Yes. Alicia?
There is technically a barrier to becoming a member. There is membership change to have an individual majority vote. So not just any school can join, there has to be approval by the current IB plus groups.
I think there's only three other schools that would be eligible if they stand for the
MIT?
They're already
in it. Stanford, Berkeley, and Chicago, the only ones west of Mississippi.
So basically, if Stanford or Berkeley has to join us, we can change the rules. The thing is, if this is something that's vital, if you cannot vote on the rules, change it, and have to pass the proposed amendment. If it's not something that's vital that would change the board, and I think the right course of action would be to get these concerns down, and then we'll send them to their delegates for the next IB Plus meeting, and we'll have them revise and modify the rules to more explicitly express our concerns there. But that way we don't necessarily send in front of the entire body.
Your next newspaper says.
Yeah, no, I was just, my last follow-up was just the entry for the dean's group, because if schools can be added to the dean's group, then they are going to be through. But that was my last thing, but I can definitely talk to you and Misha after. Thank you.
Matt?
I'm sure I can actually have sort of a proposal, but that's sort of rewriting this, which I think it's went out a lot of luck. But behind us, my concerns, and I haven't described them online, is that are that the mechanism laid out doesn't line up. If you want to have rotating host, maybe until years and everyone you get such a group home every single year seems to be an odd for that in terms of if we're having a designated hosting cycle, make it so it's more of a lock-in cycle, and perhaps obviously you can have to carve out more, if it's more than X hundreds of miles, which is what I think would allow you to say, all the IB Plus are completely northeast of my Chicago. I just so encouraged from that. And potentially also, just looking at something like 969-71, this is a very minor difference, but it just seems superfluous in that you can vote on it during the IB Plus, but you can just do it over email. Mine is going to be done over email, is it a default? And I don't mean this as a reason we need to change it, I'm just saying that to me it seems it's wrapped in a manner that leaves weird things. And there's just one that wants to vote for these strict interpretation rules, can lead to nonsense of results. I don't think that helps anyone. But I haven't tried to avoid helping turn online, but I think it's the document is not best, actually, I'm nearly accurate at best. But I think that I'm also not at the point where I think we should vote or not. But it doesn't really need to work.
Victoria?
Yeah, so I just have a comment. I do think these discussions are very good enough to have in front of the entire body. That's just the only comment I would say, but in the essence of time, I would just ask that people to help.
And just briefly, in the meeting packet as well as the agenda that I sent out, there is a document that lays out the IB Plus kind of creating this document.
There are speakers, this is currently.
Welcome to the next meeting. Some discussion.
There's been a motion to table this resolution until the next meeting. Is there a second?
I have a question on that motion.
Yes.
Would that be made an issue for the fact that the next meeting or the last meeting, would we still be able to vote and pass it?
Yes. We would be able to. It has already been introduced at the meeting, so therefore we can vote on it at any subsequent meeting as long as it's not taken, like sent to a committee or something. Yes, it's current voting numbers, not the ones that will take, that will send in June 1st.
All right, I can
second. Okay, so the motion to table the resolution until the May 5th or 6th meeting has been seconded. Is there any dissent to voting on the table motion? Is there any dissent to table the motion? Seeing none, the resolution 6 has been tabled until our subsequent meeting, and I will see the chairship back to you.
Thank you. We'll get back to business. This is another resolution. And it's an introduction to resolution 4, revising the GPSA finance commission guidelines. And this is Esther,
Hi, thank you for having me here. So, we talked about the FC guidelines provision about the last GSA meeting, and this is the resolution. So, just to review, we were not here last time. The current guidelines were introduced 2.5 years ago, and since they were introduced, we've noticed some ambiguities or mistakes in the guidelines, and we are introducing some minor revisions. And you can find the list of changes and the revised guidelines from the GPSA back in the GPSA website, and you can comment, leave a comment on the website or leave your questions there. And the final text of the document will be the last meeting, right? So after we read your comments, we'll incorporate your feedback and present it here next meeting. So I think that's all I'd like to say.
How are you getting the word out to the general graduate professional student community that this is being revised and is working?
So I sent out an email to both GSA users and the email list. I think people that not everyone got that email, but I don't know, maybe it'd be standard. And I also sent out the implementation forms. So all organizations who have who are admins on forms they should get. Please.
So we can just add to that, but I think the likes will also be posting the ability to Facebook and social media.
That was really my question. Outside of the people who attend this meeting, how are we letting people know? And is there an expectation that, are you expecting that people who receive the GPSA email are then going to share it with their people and constituents?
I would hope so. That's this body's for, right?
So you get that email, send it out to the respondent.
Okay. So, show of hands, who received the email?
So, we're going to send an email.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
financial Google nerd, I think. So, have you received comments so far, and do you have plans on how you're going to bring them?
Yes, I have. I need to talk with the FC, but so certain comments are more like, I don't understand this. This part here, could you like explain it more? Because it was more like about all these crazy things and not substantial. Yeah, so I mean, the GPSDFC will look at all the comments and decide if they can incorporate it or not. They can.
Any other questions?
This is my last one. when it comes to there, one of the changes was about the schedule for when things happen. Have you thought of ways to deal with the fact that if an organization has an event the first week of school in August, there's this conflict because they can't submit the budget.
So they can submit, but refuse things, right? So that. Well, it's just no way around it because the FC only meet after class, right? So we need to review budgets, right? FC needs to review the budget, and there is not really a way to do it at the moment. But if you have any suggestions, we can think about it. I mean, a potential idea could be that we could make another budget cycle at the end of the academic year. But yeah, since they're probably transitioning to the two campus groups, it's not.
So on that topic, would it be possible to have some sort of clause saying that like if an event occurred the schedule would occur before the first GBSAFC review cycle, would they still be look like would they wait for a requirement?
I also wanted to mention that we do have summer budgets, so for events that occur like over the summer for the semester, there's a separate one that you submitted the semester before, and that way things can happen before the semester starts. But I guess you're talking about like a specific week.
Like the first week of class. Like, welcome back, High School Social. We are the book section for the first week of class.
I guess one thing based on the date, so curious, I know this is based also on the FC's availability, but are you considering having another, currently last March is the last day of every month, including summer, and are you considering opening one at the end of April, so you would be with same day? And second, I know this is technically part of the funding guidelines, but are there ways of either putting out resources? I know you mentioned earlier, Ariana, I think that it will be resources to just like tell all the groups of these funding guidelines and kind of go over to them. So, can you talk a little more about that?
So, the very first question, yes. I think that would be possible. Should do that actually. And we'll put out a kind of a quick guide of how to submit budgets and just the guidelines and how they work. But we can only do it after we decide on which platform are we going to use. So, and we probably heard we're transitioning to campus. And we need to see how that works. And it's about to take snapshot and say how we need to have that.
As a follow-up to that, so I was assuming I know they've been talking about like rolling this out for a while. I still don't know when they will, but assuming that's like right before classes start, then you're going to have a whole bunch of groups with no idea what to do.
and won't have been registered, and stuff like that. So are you taking that into account that there will be some flexibility in the start of next year?
Yes.
Any other questions? Introduction to Resolution 1 has been formally introduced to the Assembly. Next, our next meeting will be formally discussing it. And in the meantime, we will go ahead and comment on the UFC guidelines on the Assembly's website.
It's up now.
It's up now. And Facebook. Check Facebook, yeah. Any questions? Okay, so let's move on to our other order of business, which is committee Q&A updates. From exec, just remember, if you're interested in running for a position, go over those subscriptions and let me or any of the exec members or council may have any questions on the main decision. So I encourage you all to do that. Operations.
For those voting members who were newly elected, if you could come see.
Appropriations.
I do have a question for appropriations. So what is the current status in terms of the solicitation for
we have a few applications so far.
What's the deadline for that?
Any other questions? Finance. Presentation.
Yeah.
Student advocacy. Okay. Diversity and national status.
Meeting on Friday.
Eight in the morning.
Yeah.
Where is it?
Your chair, you get to decide the meeting time.
It's in
the van, like, lobby area. Right.
Nah.
That's a real place. So, morning.
Program.
We've got professional ball on this Saturday, 27th April. We have a bunch of tickets. These two.
Perfect. Awards.
Yes, I would like to announce the winners of the faculty awards, which have been decided. So we have 4 award winners and 2 honorable mentions. So the award winners are Angela Cornell from Law, Jenny Mann from English, Jillian Rickard from Art History and American Indian Education Service, Yao Leonard from Biomedical Engineering, and then the honorable mentions for Susan Daniel in Chemical Engineering and Michael Lee.
Can I go back to this for just 1 second? This is an award to remind me of something that's pseudo disc related. Everybody is invited to come to the Grand University Inclusion Spring Recognition Banquet, which is co hosted by DISC and the rest of the Graduate Professional Student Diversity Council organization. And so that's on April 30th from 5 to 8 in G10 Biotech. And there will be awards given there, and I'm sure the awards will be able to vote for me. So, student and faculty and staff awards.
No RSVPs?
There's an RSVP form somewhere, but on the OISD website, you might be able to find that.
Okay.
Okay.
We will be distributing that information, and general opinion.
Two weeks from today, 4 o'clock, where are you going to be? Your heart. the menu, the recommendation we had is, what you call that? Cookie cake?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there'll be dinner here, but we're not going to just give you beer without food, so there will be food. Maybe appetizers for cookie cake, and there'll be a gift for each of you. But like we did last year, you have to be there to get your gift. They met. Anything? Who was there last year? Anything else you want to say as an incentive to be there?
Not one thing.
Shh. Oh. So, 2 years.
So last year was really nice, Jim kind of put it into the context for us and kind of grow that we achieved and doing what we can. We can look at it all together. You should come by if you can. It would be really nice to get
there. Oh, that's sweet. The team will be there to also recognize you. I think you think you'll be there. We need more than 50 beer refunds.
But I made 25 books.
So my wish is 20 or 30, and how many people will drink more than one beer? Oh my god, I don't know. But I don't think you would leave the Big Red Bar with beer, but you could bring your soda over for your dinner. So we hope really to see you all there. This is fun for us.
Yeah, and you can start.
Is it up?
It's in progress.
Okay.
It'll be up tomorrow.
Yes, okay. Tomorrow you can comment on the first draft that I brought up in the last meeting. And did you hear President Pollock talk about how important it was? So really use your voice. She talked about it.
Yeah, so on that note, is there a plan to have us approve a final version for next meeting, or are we going to have like a draft over the summer to bring it in for next week?
Yeah, the updated plan is to have the draft ongoing over the summer comments, and then the final form will hopefully be at the first meeting of the next year. Yeah, and just the same question is always, how are you getting the word out that this is grad school news, every professional school news, if they allow me. Then also Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Please, if you're a field rep, give this information to your constituents. The big usual suspects. Do
you have any recommendations? Yeah. A recommendation for you. That concludes our community Q&A. Can you go on? We want to open the forum. Yes.
Thank you. So I have a question regarding elections. Where can I find information on whether or not I can campaign internally and access listservs?
So I guess if you're access to listservs, like everybody has access to the membership listserv, and if you're voting member, you have access to the voting member listserv. The only one you wouldn't have access to is the info listserv, which can be for action member. If they get that card, I can use it. I technically, so I don't know if you guys have updated the election rules. I have. So if you haven't, there should be no rules about campaigning. Traditionally, normally we haven't had that happen. You just talk to people and say you're interested in running. You just never had a campaign with alcohol.
So what we can do though is if you have something prepared and you'd like to send something out, I'm sure if you send it to the people that
and for people who are interested in running for paid positions, traditionally what happens if you never make a report is that we essentially invite any interested in being or running for that position to come up. Everybody then has, if you're running on a post, we have 30 seconds to sort of say who you are, what experience you have in that community, what you're interested in, survey that is tested rate, then normally we allow the opportunity for one or two questions from the audience before we go in. So that's only an opportunity for you to, I guess, campaign. Outside of that, there's no rule saying you can't talk to members about your candidacy.
Yeah, I'll also say thank you. I can talk to you offline. I'm just an MPA student, so I take every election.
No, I was just going to say that for context, last year I don't think there were any contestants. It was all like one person.
Anything else for a report?
Oh, yeah. If you're a new voting member, make sure you go talk to our clerk Ash and get her.
So you don't have to be talking.
I'm